Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Symmetry of Soul, in-depth synthesizing study of the Urantia Book for able and willing students. Tonight, paper 55, section 3. It is our arc on purpose and destiny. Remember, no matter how much of God we may attain, there will always remain much more of Him, the existence of which we will not even suspect. The quest for God is endless, even on the evolutionary spheres of the universes. As they progress into stages of light and life, the quest for God is endless there too. I'm Brad Garner, and I'm so glad that you're here with us live this evening on a Tuesday, or anytime you wish, in our archive at symmetryofsoul.org. With me this evening is Dr. Chris Halverson. He's our teacher. Kermit Anderson, and filling in again for Andrea Barnes this week, we have Justin Armstrong again. Glad that he's here with us. And, of course, there's you. We're glad that you're here for about 1% of your week, 2 hours. So pull up a seat, open up the text of the Urantia Book by whatever means you like, and let's get some in-depth study going on this epical revelation. Good evening, Dr. Chris.
Good evening, Brad. Hello, Kermit, and thank you, Justin, for stepping in for Andrea. And as you did last week, you did a great job last week. And hello to everyone listening. As Brad said, whether it's live or through the archive, and we are going to engage a section tonight that has a tantalizing title, generations, ages, as it were, of mankind have yearned for the golden age. So we're going to address the appropriateness of that concept here tonight.
We are indeed. It is a very evocative name with a long, rich history in different civilizations and societies, the Golden Ages. We'll find out more about that. Looking forward to it. And Justin, so glad that you're here again with us this evening, sir. How's everything out your way?
It's well, Brad. Hi, Dr. Chris. Hey, Kermit. Really excited again for tonight's show.
Yeah, we are glad that you're here. Exploring Golden Ages. I'm having to refrain from quoting song lyrics. I'm pretty sure all kinds of songs have been written about that stuff over the years, but no one needs that right now. And Kermit, how's everything going for you? And tell us what we were up to a week ago. Refresh our minds, if you would.
Okay, I'll try and do that. Everything's fine on this end. Glad to be here, and hello to all assembled around the screens and phones and however you're tapping into this broadcast. Reflections on the phenomena of adjuster fusion in the Urantia Temple led to our discussion of speculations on the structural nature of the Urantia soul in distinction to other Urantia objects. The soul being a super additive consequence of creature mind and divine adjuster led us to regard the soul in some sense as transcendent of the adjuster. Symmetry of soul in our arc on experiential deity from the eternal perspective viewed the experiential transcendent of the existential. These thoughts further led to recognizing all experiential reality as under the umbrella of Mother Deity, the Evolver, in functional harmony with the Father, the Initiator. Going even further, Symmetry of Soul noted the complexities of the implementation and direct engagement of the Father's law with experiential reality, wherein we find God's mercy. It is very easy for immature experiential beings as we to disregard the facts of the immutability of existential divine law and erroneously assume that mercy itself is existential, as suggested in the declaration of Paul in 2 Corinthians, which states, "The mercy of the Lord is from everlasting to everlasting. Yes, his mercy endures forever." Suffice it to say, it is unlikely we will see the end of mercy while in the flesh. It remains, however, that which mercy cannot rehabilitate, justice will eventually annihilate. Symmetry of Soul has over the years described a path of righteousness, starting with cultivation of the famous five favorable conditions, loyal, humble, sincere, just, and patient, Moving to personalized harmonious coordination with the three cosmic insights, catalyzed by the spirit of truth and adjuster guidance to safely achieve conformity with the cosmos in obedience to divine law. Such an attainment depends on the right exercise of our sovereignty of personality. We began our reading in section 2, death and translation. Death of a kind is inevitable for all mortals. However, the unnatural death of the mortal form is conditional upon adjuster fusion, which obviates the loss of consciousness which accompanies natural death. Upon the terminal mission of the Trinity Teacher's sons on a world at the immediate threshold of the era of light and life, about one quarter of the planetary citizens are exempt from natural death. In further stages of light and life, an individual's readiness for fusion is noted by midwares or their associates, and following an orderly chain of command results in a summons from the planetary sovereign for the candidate to settle their planetary affairs and report to the Marantia Temple to await Marantia transit. From estimates of planetary population and numbers of midwares available for such duties, Symmetry of Soul speculates substantial numbers of midware associates will be required. Symmetry of Soul further conjectures that the associates hereto referred could very well be the spirit servers referred to in paper 13, section 1, paragraph 20 in The Secrets of Seraphington. Descriptions of the particulars of events transpiring in the Marantia Temple with fusion candidates, assembled friends and associates, and the celestial personalities required to protect them from the fusion flash provided grist for Symmetry of Soul co-host's comedic imaginative banter, inasmuch as one can have only the faintest concept of what these actualities involve. We can, however, have some idea of the tenor of the occasion being celebratory and ecstatically joyous, in contrast with the sorrow and mourning of contemporary funerals. And again, straining our powers of imagination, what are spiritual fires and flames in contrast to material conflagrations, even nuclear events, with which we are most familiar? The energetics of these matter, mind, spirit, and deity transactions are impossible to imagine, albeit our study of the fifth epical revelation tells us there are specific and precise cosmic physics in play. These transactions of adjuster transit of translated souls to the appropriate Marantia resurrection halls at infinite velocity are supervised by an archangel sent to normal worlds on their first day of light and life. This caught our attention inasmuch as the archangel circuit we have on Urantia was operational for the first time at the dispensational resurrection at the time of Michael's Easter Sunday resurrection 2,000 years ago. By the time a planet reaches the fourth stage of light and life, over half the planetary mortals achieve terrestrial escape by translation. This proportion continues to increase, but our author has not encountered any evolutionary world where natural death has been entirely eliminated. Such statements should disabuse us from spending any time imagining our fusion while yet in the flesh. We are reminded that translated souls from worlds in advanced stages of light and life are exempt from passing through the training regimes of the system and constellation, albeit they do return to those worlds as teachers. It strains the imagination again to attempt to conceive of material mortals attaining such advanced status or evolutionary worlds attaining such advanced civilization, which embody the qualities equivalent to graduates of the constellation training programs. This should inspire us to strive for ever more cosmic alignment in our current form. We likely possess more capacity and capability for cosmic coordination and progress than we currently exercise. Now let's find out about golden ages, which usually, in my experience, have been historical references to past ages, but here we're finding out their future ahead of us. So let's proceed.
All right. Thank you so much, Kermit. And thank you for the generous reference to our comedic talents. I think that was liberal praise, to say the least, but I appreciate it. Your Urantia humor. It's a little drier than your average Far Side cartoon, I'd say. But so it goes.
It's definitely more esoteric.
Definitely. Yeah. But hopefully a little less grotesque. Who knows? Well, I'm looking forward to our look into the Golden Ages too. At least you've got a more erudite conception of Golden Ages. For me, it's the bonus stage you enter in the Civilization video games when everything becomes easier for a while. So, I'm decidedly proletariat in my notions here. Whatever. It was a very eventful discussion last week. We spent half the show just sort of talking about various things about liberty and law. That was very informative. But then, of course, we talked death and translation. Before I sort of opened it up to everyone else, I just kind of wanted to report that I sort of left the show with that thought on my mind, that mild challenge, maybe an admonishment they offered to us about it would be decidedly helpful if less advanced mortals could only learn to view natural death with something of this cheerfulness and lightheartedness. And, you know, I just thought about the funerals that I've been to and, you know, paused and pondered my own mortality. And then, coincidence would have it, I found out just about an hour ago before showtime, my 106-year-old great-aunt just passed away overnight last night. And I just thought, you know, if ever there was an event that would hint that, that mortality is something that doesn't have to be somber and just preternaturally sad and sorrowful, it would be the passing of someone who lived 106 years. I mean, they were pretty quality years. She was an impressive person. Like, we've all got to go sometime. We don't have to be sorrowful about it. So they issue us a challenge that even now, it seems we would do well to reconceive our funerals, even right now, where we're currently at. And I just had that on my mind. People have thought and talked about that a lot. But, yeah.
You have to be very careful, of course, appearing too lighthearted at a funeral of someone maybe of tender years. That's going to be not well understood necessarily by the other attendees.
Yeah. No, it is. Not to make light of it. Yeah, the taboos and the mores and everything around all of those are there for very good reason. You know, there have been people who have, in very gaudy fashion, tried to, even in the Urantia Book readership, people have tried to, you know, have these sort of graduation parties. And I mean, I've never personally been to one, but the reports I've heard is they seem inauthentic. They seem like they're sort of caricatures or stereotypes just lifted chapter and verse out of the Urantia Book rather than being a spontaneous, more personality-driven thing. It's just, be careful when you replace something that has been around for a while. Make sure you're replacing it with something better.
Yeah, but certainly it's not an improvement to go from, people's historically that if you had a high degree of affectation to their mourning, including hiring professional mourners, just to make a big show about what a tragedy this is, that someone in your clan has died. You don't want to flip that around, to fake joy, as a replacement for fake sorrow. So, like you were saying, Brad, I mean,
right.
It's what they're talking about is that which is naturally predicated on an objective recognition. It's not you, basically doing a fancy version of Whistling Past the Graveyard.
Right, exactly. I think maybe the only time I've ever read of one of these occasions that seemed authentic was in the book Tuesdays with Maury, which was about a philosophy professor from Brandeis University who was near the end of his life and had a debilitating disease, but he decided, and you know, he was very philosophically inclined and very authentic, at least in the way it was portrayed. He decided to hold a living wake for himself before he died, and it was this celebration with food and laughter. I mean, people felt a little awkward and they stared at their toes for a while, but eventually they followed him as essentially their cultural leader, him saying, no, this really is okay. I wouldn't want to be younger. I was miserable when I was 18. I'm exactly the age I ought to be, and these are the things that happen. So eat up, be merry. It at least seemed authentic, but it was unorthodox. So, plenty to think about there. Including maybe it's time to reread Tuesdays with Maury. It's been a while. That's a good book. Recommended for any Urantia book reader, I would say. Anything else on anyone's mind? Thoughts, reflections?
Yeah, Justin, did you have anything that you were thinking about from last week?
Well, I was thinking about the topic we were just on, and before it mentions how it would be decidedly helpful if less advanced mortals could learn to view natural death with something of the same cheerfulness and lightheartedness. The very beginning of that paragraph, it kind of sets the tone where it talks about the soul of these progressing mortals are increasingly filled with faith, hope, and assurance. So that individual is already in that state, and then there's a spirit that's permeating everyone around them. So it's this sort of communal spirit that's permeating the process. And that setup of having that spirit permeate everyone involved, I think, is something that's very difficult for us to even imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not to mention the technical issue that you bring up there, which is tied to what they pointed out in the preceding paragraph. You know, when they say the souls of these progressing mortals are increasingly filled with faith, hope, and assurance, here's an example of definitely don't just think of the word soul as that Maranja object. There is that, and Kermit was talking about that some in the review, but that upper domain in the hourglass analogy of our adjutant mindful selves, that spirit, that personalized self of spiritualized mind, that is significantly dominant in these individuals over the lower domain. And there's a high degree of self-mastery. And as I was pointing out in the preceding paragraph, I mentioned this as we read it last week, and it says the scenes of weeping and wailing characteristic of earlier epochs of human evolution are now replaced by ecstatic joy and the sublimest enthusiasm of these God-knowing mortals.
Right.
Right? The reason there's all of this, genuine sorrow, not to mention, pretend sorrow and all this sort of stuff. I mean, it's because, by and large, we're talking about beings here that are technically human but don't avail themselves of much of their spiritualized mind and the stability it can offer in their lives. So they're torn about by the vicissitudes of the external world, and it's a very stark thing for that lower domain when someone close to you dies, because your lower domain has no innate sense of eternity.
Right.
It has no innate belief, in an ongoing existence. It's an animal origin, mortal self, innately and nothing more. So, the only way that this can genuinely occur, even begin to genuinely occur, right, is when, as Justin was pointing out, not only the individual but all those around them, are way beyond being merely born again, let alone not even yet being born again, but are born again, so that they're God-knowing.
Yeah.
Right? So that God isn't just a belief that is seriously challenged by an event like death. If you're God-knowing, right, it doesn't matter if all earthly things crash. It's all, secondary to your foundational knowingness. You know the unchanging, unchangeable God. Yeah, if that's your starting point, changelessness, change no longer impacts you like it used to.
Right.
This is a basic litmus test so that you can, don't start with others, start with yourself. And that you can impose upon yourself, am I God-knowing? Well, do you start with changelessness or not so much? It's a sobering thing to ask oneself, obviously, but, by grace you can get there, but, don't use some clever species of self-deception to delusionally, deem yourself to already be there.
Yeah.
Face facts. You were born into this world far from that goal. Very, very far from that goal. And the only reason that goal is even possible is pure grace. When you came out of your mother's womb, you were a long ways away yet from even having all seven adjutants. You were a long ways away from even having all five animal adjutants. You're a pretty limited animal creature when you're born. To have the courage to face that and to recognize in this context, come back around full circle here, to recognize that we're talking about not only a civilization that we can't imagine, but people we can't imagine.
Right.
None of us can remotely imagine the kind of internal integrity that these individuals we're talking about have. You've never seen it. It's way more than Jesus displayed for us. Now, as we've talked about before, these are very advanced animal origin beings we're talking about here.
Well, we have a caller.
Okay.
I'm going to bring her in. I don't know who it is, actually.
All right.
You're on Symmetry of Soul.
Hello, everybody. This is Zabe.
Oh, hi, Zabe.
Hey. How you doing, Zabe?
I'm doing good. What I just wanted to add into it, when my father died a few years ago and he was Catholic, instead of having the black funeral mass, I convinced a friend of mine who was a priest to have a white ceremony mass. And instead of having everybody mourning and everything, we celebrated his life. And also I got to read two or three paragraphs out of the papers about eternal life. So we can slowly, but slowly upstep the darkness of death by being a little bit more lighthearted, and it worked out really good, and everybody was really happy that we celebrated his life instead of mourned his death. And that's what I just wanted to add in there, that we can upstep a little bit the other ceremonies if we try.
Mm. Sure.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, and that's a great point to bring in, to tie to what I was just saying, Zabe, that even though these individuals that we're reading about in Light and Life are way beyond us in integrity, we still have an adjuster right now, which is the potential for all of our future integrity. And the degree to which it can help to bring sort of a foreshadowing of a future mankind's integrity, into the present now, right? There can be a ceremony like you're describing, that isn't just everyone kind of, pretending. Like Brad is saying, that there's a sense sometimes that it's all, everyone is kind of just kind of faking it, right? That, we're joyful for his life. But really they're terrified, of their own mortality the whole time. That adjuster, even, even when we're a long ways away from any sort of direct, interplay with it as a first circler, nonetheless, it's a rock of integrity in our minds. Even the shadow it can cast, down to some budding sincerity below is significant. I agree with you, Zabe. We should encourage ourselves to, no matter what our state of development, no matter how lowly, encourage ourselves to seek a source of integrity within us that's transcendent of where we know we are right now. And we might find that we can benefit from that in, more than we imagined.
Well, thank you very much, Chris. And one other little thing was after the, when everybody was gathered together, my wife and I, we went back to the cemetery. And because my dad was in the motion picture industry, there was tens of thousands of dollars worth of flowers out and wreaths and everything else.
Yeah.
And so we took all of them apart and brought them back to the people. And it was amazing that nobody wanted to take these beautiful flowers because they were funeral flowers. So what we did, we just went around to everybody's who helped my mother out and put big bouquets on their front porch. So we can make happiness out of even sadness, and that's all I have to say.
I don't know, Zabe. That sounds awfully close to eating the sacrificial animal. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. They go. Was that? Were those from the flowers that people sent to your dad on at his grave? And I go, yeah. I don't think we want those right now.
Yes. Shades of sacrilege.
Right. So they just put them on their front porch, and everybody, I don't know what they did with them, but I felt better.
Yeah.
Shades of moving out of the house that someone died in and never even occupying it again. That kind of older forms of concern of ghosts being up to no good out there.
Right. Well, you all have a good one now, and we'll get on with the show.
Thanks, Zabe. That's great.
Thank you, Zabe.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Glad to hear from you.
Zabe's
regularly in our chat room helping us out with keeping up with the text as we read along. So we thank you for your efforts in there, Zabe.
Yeah, 8 or 9 years now I've been doing it, so it's kind of a habit.
There you go.
Okay, Bye, everybody.
Yep.
Bye-bye. Yep.
Bye-bye, Zabe.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, this, you know, it's always a challenge when we're unpacking the revelation. When, you know, one of the first steps is to very clearly delineate what you're reading from what you already know, you know, so that there's a potential for revelation to happen rather than, you know, affirmation.
Right.
But at the same time, to not so separate it as, you know, as to divorce your current state from, you know, the grace that it already possesses, and certainly from, you know, the infinite potential that it already possesses. You know, it's always a difficult conversation, you know, and, you know, you can kind of get bogged down constantly. It's like, okay, you know, we're saying this, but, you know, don't take that too far. It's still the case that, you know, like we were talking last week, you know, if you very definitively speak about the absoluteness of the divine law, it's like, well, wait a minute, what about the absoluteness of the divine love? It's like, okay, they're both absolute.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's, you know, you have kind of just that basic kind of rudimentary philosophic challenge in the fifth epical revelation when they go from a simple childlike monotheistic recognition, you know, where you bring in a little bit of philosophic thought and you use the word absolute. It's like, oh, I acknowledge the existence of the absolute. You know, but it's like, well, okay, but there's not just one absolute. There's a complexity to absoluteness. And, you know, and this can get very, very complicated immediately for an immature philosophic mind. Because if you focus very definitively on the unqualified absolute, it's like, well, what about the deity absolute? Or even more so, what about the, you know, the volitional absolute? What about the universal father? It's like, well, okay, we haven't thrown those away. But if we're going to recognize the absoluteness of a particular absolute, you need to focus very, very narrowly and definitively on it so that you don't fuzz out its absoluteness. Yeah, but if you do that, you know, do you have enough mind capacity to not, you know, completely lose sight of parallel absoluteness?
Those aren't your everyday coffee shop conversations, Chris.
No, they aren't. nothing about the fifth epical revelation is such, and, you know, when you actually look closely. No matter how much something might appear to be something you could toss out in an elevator speech, it's not really like that. It's always in the context of a very, very challenging enormity of cosmology.
You know, when we talk about... Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Kermit.
No, go ahead, Jess.
I was just going to bring up when we discuss this development of spiritualized mind and the integrity of the individuals in this era of light and life in this funeral situation, the phrase of the peace that passes all understanding just keeps coming to my mind, and how even here and now in this material comfort era, it seems like we're capable of having these little flashes, little moments where there's just sort of this glimpse of that concept of the peace that passes all understanding. So I just want to throw that out there.
I've often told the story about we were reading the Cosmic Fruits of the Spirit one time in a study group. You get to that final one, Enduring Peace, and someone piped up, I experienced enduring peace one time.
Wait a minute.
You know, it's, you know, this just gets, you know, it's like, you know, not only did you not experience enduring peace, see, look how far removed that actually is from peace that passes all understanding. It's completely understandable that you stumbled upon an environment for a few moments in your life where all was pleasant. Okay. That's understandable. Peace that passes all understanding is peace in the situations where people believe peace is impossible. Right? Everyone is dying and all is crumbling all around you, and yet you're at peace. That kind of godlike changelessness as the foundation within yourself, which gets us back to what we were just talking about with the funerals and quote-unquote funerals and during these light and life circumstances. You won't have to imagine enduring peace if you're genuinely God-knowing. It's automatic, right? Because you stand on that which can't be moved. You can't be unpeaced. And it's just hard to, for us to even imagine. It's like, you could be hit really hard, upside the head with a sledgehammer, and that had knocked a piece out of you. No. Nothing can move God.
Right.
It's where that phrase that you often mention, Chris, of all human knowledge, that which is of the greatest value is to know the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it. It's where that becomes so significant as we're aiming for that. In that direction.
Yeah.
We have an example. We have the way.
Yeah, and it's an achievable aim. And if you firmly know that if you supply the favorable conditions, you'll get there, and that these unimaginable elements of integrity will be automatic fruits of your spiritual nature, then it isn't so scary to read what it says right after they list the cosmic fruits of the Spirit. Where it's pretty stark stuff. About how you are dead if you don't manifest these fruits of the Spirit. And, you will soon be eliminated. It all sounds very, very scary. If you don't understand up front that, there's nothing really to be afraid of. It just set your aim precisely on that goal, supply the favorable conditions, you'll get there, those fruits will be automatic, there's nothing really to fear. But, again, it's just, that's another thing, to not stop reading at the end of the list of the cosmic fruits of the Spirit, but to read the rest of the paragraph, and see how it makes you feel. Is it too scary and you decide, I'm always going to stop at the end of the list. I'm not going to read the rest of that paragraph again. Because it was all very exciting until after the period there. It's just courageous and independent cosmic thinking. The divine law, that leads to the rest of that paragraph being so stark like that, divine law doesn't have to be scary. It should eventually supply, the predicate for that enduring peace. I mean, you have enduring peace because you know no real harm can befall you. The divine law you stand on and are framed by is absolutely unchanging.
The divine upholding has never ceased, never lapsed for a moment,
And to a human, it's a source of joy, the divine law. To a fearful animal origin, technical human, it makes you almost catatonic with fear to contemplate it, and that's what can get you, unfortunately, off on these tangents of, being unwittingly on the path towards sin and iniquity, apart from the divine law, in other words, because you're too afraid to face its existence. So you end up, in the name of following the love of God instead of the law of God, you end up, losing the love of God, because you can't get the love of God outside of the law of God. There is no such love. You don't want to, if people would just pause and emotionally consider at the consequences, they would clearly say to themselves, I don't want to be the poster child for that sentence, and so it came to pass that they cried for mercy, but there was no ear open to hear. You thought the divine law was scary. How about that sentence? Trust. And that what you really want is that integrity. Just a little dose of identification with that immutable integrity. Eventually, funerals are not, these days of dirges.
Right. But they're authentic. They're not pantomime. They're not caricatures. Yeah. You really know. Yeah.
Right. Not only do you know that no real harm can befall you, no real harm can befall the loved one that just died.
Yeah.
They are part of eternity. No matter how far they are from literally standing on the Isle of Paradise. In truth, they already do stand there. So no real harm can befall them.
Good. Helpful conversation as always. Helpful to go through these things. Love and law. Yeah.
Maybe just one little thing before we start reading the Golden Ages that Kermit brought up. That whole issue of Golden Age, isn't that what people, imagine back to rather than imagine forward to?
Right.
And so, that's a great initial point, to bring to mind. When you're very, very primitive still of mind, that's where you turn when you think of a golden age as some imagined past time. You really aren't a human identified to the future yet. You're an animal, functionally still looking back to the past.
Is that similar to the back to nature concept, Chris? That same reverence for back to nature?
Yep.
Okay.
Of course. See, because it's back. See, it's in other words, the golden age was sometime in the past, like Kermit said. And the idea that you know, we're just moving farther and farther away from the light of the golden age of the past, which means we're obviously moving into darkness. We need to go back to simpler times, et cetera. All those sorts of notions. See, that's an animal origin mind that really does not know the future, the existence of the future. It doesn't have foresight. It isn't really availing itself of its personality. It's just a mindful self that has a memory of the past that it extrapolates back to a golden age, you know, and an awareness in the present, and that's it. So, you know, step one to getting to what we're talking about, going to be talking about in this section is okay, at least flipping it around and imagining that the real, you know, as you might say, golden age is going to be in the future, right, that there's a purpose and a destiny to the universe, existentially, you know, superimposed upon it by the first source and center of all things and beings, right, so that, you know, the proper, you know, concept of a golden age would be in the future. Everything is progressing. So it, if you're going to, you know, have the adjective golden for the best of the best, you know, that's going to be in the future, not the past.
This reminds me in the civilizational arc, Chris, when you talked about those three terms, preserve, observe, and conserve, and how you're conserving the ideals into the future. It makes me think about having that holistic framework of all three.
Yeah. And, you know, that desperately trying to somehow preserve a long-gone golden age, you know, that gets you into very unfortunate modalities of living. It's like, no, flip it around. Don't try to preserve, you know, conserve the truth that's flowing forward towards the fact of a golden age. And then the addition, of course, is just that it's a plural. It's not the golden age, it's the golden ages. Right? And we're talking about the stages of light and life. You know, that's, you know, a quite revolutionary, you know, a little element to throw into the mix. You know, that there's, you know, a sevenfoldness to goldenness. There's gold and golder and, you know, golder still and yet golder still. And, you know, so, you know, just again to, you know, that's along the lines of, you know, we've talked in the past about any sort of concept that you have, no matter how validly you recognize it, don't put a ceiling on it. Right? Keep it open to flow ever, you know, eventually into endless cycles of eternity. You know? You know, and we're, you know, we're going to, you know, in this paper we're going to see a, sort of a first order sevenfoldness of goldenness and then a second order sevenfoldness of goldenness. But that's just finite. Think of the transcendent, you know, who knows how many levels upon levels, sets of levels upon sets of levels of goldenness lie ahead in the, you know, in the absentite. Yeah, so that keeping that ceiling off of your concept
and
so
all of the
truth can flow through it always.
When you're describing the potential of the complexity, I can't help but think of all the levels of associativity that aren't possible yet in just the finite age that will be potentially possible when the absentite age begins and it interfaces with what used to be the finite age.
Yeah.
Just like a Havona native receiving an adjuster as an experiential relationship of meeting a mortal ascender. There's a new potential, a new super additive consequence. That same process continues on and on and on and on.
All right, so, yeah, there's just, you know, always, you know, keeping it so that it you're sort of perforce to strike Seth with a dynamic concept. The animal origin part of us is lazy and wants to conceive of a static, approach, and in that sense, approachable concept. It doesn't want to have to get up to speed, right, and synchronize. It just wants to kind of, lackadaisically wander, toward it when it feels like it, and, it's just sitting there, and eventually you'll get there. So keep the ceilings off, keep it from freezing into some static concept. Keep your concepts living, keep yourself living. All right, so
indeed,
keep all that
in
just
yes.
A simple three-word title.
All right, well, let's explore it a little bit more now. Paper 55 of the Urantia book, The Spheres of Light and Life. And tonight it is Section 3, The Golden Ages, page 624 of the original single column text. During this age of light and life, the world increasingly prospers under the fatherly rule of the planetary sovereign. By this time, the worlds are progressing under the momentum of one language, one religion, and on normal spheres, one race. But this age is not perfect. These worlds still have well-appointed hospitals, homes for the care of the sick. There still remain the problems of caring for accidental injuries and the inescapable infirmities attendant upon the decrepitude of old age and the disorders of senility. Disease has not yet been entirely vanquished. Neither have the earth animals been subdued in perfection. But such worlds are like paradise in comparison with the early times of primitive man during the preplanetary prince age. You would instinctively describe such a realm, could you be suddenly transported to a planet in this stage of development, as heaven on earth.
Well, that's a fun juxtaposition between the middle of that paragraph and the end of that paragraph.
Senility, heaven on earth, huh?
Yeah, I mean, notice the
still?
Interesting
yeah.
Little tidbit of scientific disclosure there. Inescapable infirmities attended upon the decrepitude of old age. Right.
He's pushing 600. He's really getting senile.
Right, so even with all of this incredible advanced technology, we had unimaginable technology at the end of the post-Adamic sun age, right, on a normal world, and we've gone way, 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 way beyond that, change, these inescapable facts, and at some, you're mortal. At some point, there's going to be a less living interplay between your dead matter and life animation. And when there
it's just not intended to endure, is it?
Right.
It's just not intended to endure forever. It's got to run out.
The moment that life animation isn't so intimately, engaged to the dead matter, that means the mechanical mind can't be as holistically engaged. This means the first agitant can't be as whole. Goes all the way up the stack, which means the Holy Spirit can't be as dynamically engaged, etc.
Yeah.
So right, the whole stack, eventually collapses because you pull the rug out from underneath it. And there's no way, no amount of science can manipulate, life animation being engaged to it. I mean, the revelators tell you they don't understand that stuff at all.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's completely lost in the mysteries of very transcendent deity interplay with reality. Not not stuff that you can manipulate with reality science, no matter how advanced.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's that. You know, I mean, obviously, you know, you could still have accidents, and now, you know, that's understandable. But you know, just to keep in mind that there isn't magic here in this, you know, in these scientific achievements. Facts are still facts.
It's weird to say this, but I mean, I suppose that's supposed to be comforting to us in a certain way. There's plenty of people who think, well, you know, the life we have here is distorted by rebellion and our genetics are all messed up, but you know, on more normal worlds or more advanced worlds, yeah, you know, it wouldn't be as sorry as what we have it here. It's like, no, you're mortal. You know, from dust you came, and dust your body shall return. It's inescapable. I mean, it's like, so the cosmos is deeply designed this way, down to its roots. So, like, oddly, take comfort in that. Like, don't fear decrepitude and senility as if they are anti-cosmic. They're part of it somehow.
Our mortality, you know, and all of its consequences are an inescapable part of the divine law.
Yeah.
And, you know, God made you to die. Good luck trying to change that. That which God has done, you're not going to alter. He made you to die. It's the divine law in play.
I'm imagining in this age of light and life, a little particle still hitting the double helix DNA and just breaking it apart. Like, that's still going to happen. It's still part of the process.
Yes. Not to mention, whoops, there was a cliff edge there. you know, but even, you know, even disease has not been entirely vanquished. See, so, you know, there's, you know, you're getting down to, I mean, all of the diseases that we can immediately imagine have been vanquished because those are very coarse level diseases. But, you know, the longer you did and the longer you live and the more refined your body is, you know, the more there's these very, very subtle things that you're going to have to deal with. And, and so you're constantly working on the next iteration of refinement of body and diseases related to that refinement. And then, of course, there's the politically incorrect, the earth animals have not been subdued in perfection. We've talked about that some before. But you know, notice that they wanted to remind us, right, of some of these issues, you know, and they'll continue to do that as we go through, you know, the descriptions of light and life. There, you know, there's, you know, this whole bit of mind made and personality managed. It goes on and on and on and on. Animals are not personalities; they don't manage themselves. Right? Not to mention, if you want to limit hospital visits, you want to eventually subdue all of the creatures that would poison you or eat you or whatnot.
So does that mean that wild beasts will be tamed or they'll be eliminated?
Right, that's always the question. Exactly, how does this all work? I mean,
what do you do with that Wolverine? You know, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, it seems unlikely that you're going to fix it all with genetic engineering. You know, turn all the lions into lambs with genetic engineering. You probably just don't have lions.
Yeah.
Can we get rid of mosquitoes too? Thought. But I digress. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Lots of questions.
Right, but nonetheless, right? It's just, you know, it's having, you know, it's being. You know, if you will, bold enough to recognize that in a God-based universe, you know, the deified levels of reality are ultimately in control. Personality. It's deity over reality. And then the other fun little point there is right in the beginning. So when it says, during this age of light and life, the world increasingly prospers under the fatherly rule of the planetary sovereign. You know, we've mentioned that we've got a planetary sovereign instead of a planetary prince now that we've gotten into light and life. But for them to use that expression, okay, recall the levels, the hierarchy of fathers. If you go to paper 51, see again, you know, here we are seeing, you know, they're kind of hinting back at something, you know, not too many papers back. If you go to the end of section 6 in paper 51, which is on page 587 in a single column, right, there's that famous hierarchy, sevenfold hierarchy of fathers. And, you know, special note, right, you know, one notch above the biologic father is the father, so-called father of the realm, the planetary Adam. Well, remember how at the beginning of this Light and Life paper, we were noting them talking about the, you know, the world as a realm, you know, relative to, you know, this sovereign, this planetary sovereign. And what you experience as you're moving through light and life, the stages of light and life, is a transition from, you know, before light and life, the father of the realm is the planetary Adam, period. But then it's a gradual handoff until eventually the Adam and Eve leave the world, and the father of the realm is the planetary sovereign, period. And in between, there's a sharing of being the father of the realm. So, you know, that just, you know, they're wanting you to, you know, by saying it directly like that, to recognize that there's a transition that occurs on a world where the second level in the hierarchy, you know, eventually is in the hands of normally a Lenanadec, you know, rather than a material son.
Right.
Yeah, and see, so then it kind of, you know, then it matches up, you know, planetary sovereign, system sovereign, you know, et cetera, up the hierarchy. And we'll, as we get going here a little bit more in this paper, we'll see them begin to talk about that issue of slowly transferring, those planetary duties, you know, from the hands of the Adam and Eve over to the planetary sovereign.
Human government in the conduct of material affairs continues to function throughout this age of relative progress and perfection. The public activities of a world in the first stage of light and life, which I recently visited, were financed by the tithing technique. Every adult worker and all able-bodied citizens worked at something, paid 10% of his income or increase to the public treasury, and it was dispersed as follows.
So before we get into the disbursement here, we have to remember what we've just recently gone through as we went through all of those planetary mortal epics, you know, with the dispensations. And remember, as we kind of left this conversation about government, we had pushed things very far forward to where there was so much integrity in the individuals that, you know, except for the very large scale logistic issues, you don't need government. Right?
Remember that.
That, you know, that representative government as the divine ideal, is, in a number of ways being outgrown. know, because of the advanced internal integrity, you know, self-mastery that all the individuals have, you know, so that they're much more self-governing in all the details and don't have to be governed, you know, from an external, you know, relative to an external reference.
They don't need the phrase, he who will not work shall not eat.
Yeah,
they're a little past that.
And exactly, and in that mode, you see, and all able-bodied citizens worked at something. Yeah, so this is, see, this is a very interesting little aside that our mighty messenger does here. Shades of government on a neighboring planet. Right, of giving a few little details. Only now it's not a world that, you know, a fellow rebel world, you know, like the neighboring planet paper is about, you know, in a post-default Adam and Eve pre-magisterial sun state. Now, here's a little bit of data about a world in the first stage of light and life, including amazingly specific details like we're about to read about the disbursement here. Yeah, which again should remind everyone of the kind of details like that that are in the neighboring planet paper.
Yeah.
But two things, right, about this, you know, before we look at before we start to think about any details they tell us, okay, everyone has to remember this is only applicable to a world in the first stage of light and life, with all kinds of individual internal integrity. You know, and if one goes, oh, well, we should, you know, we should get Congress to pass a law that makes all these things, you know, it's like, no. so there's, you know, that's always the case when you're thinking about these, you know, these statements like this. But the other thing, the tithing isn't just a curious thing on this planet, you know, that you can wonder, where did that get started and what's up with that? You know, well, the Revelator is going to give you some hints about how that all got started and whatnot with the, you know, with the past Revelators. But notice, see, it's universe of universes wide, obviously. It's not just, they didn't just toss that scheme out on this planet. It's like, well, you guys could do this tithing thing. It's like, no, that's part of every world, which is fascinating. Why a tenth? Why is that somehow, you know, sort of part of the divine law, if you will, the divine way?
My first thought, Chris, is you've got the seven in terms of the spiritual side of the equation, and on the power side you have the 10 in terms of the decimal qualities of physical aspects. So that's the first thing that jumps out at me.
Yeah, right. That gets you tenfold, but why one out of the 10? Why one-tenth? And, you know, let's play your thought forward. You know, that speculation would lead you to go, well, maybe the reason it's a tenth is because, you know, there's 10 phases of physical energy. When all is said and done, if you include all of the master physical controllers, there's some degree of control over 9 of those, 9/10. The other 10th is to God. One could be suspicious. Is it actually modeled after, after that? That one of the 10 phases, or you know, is a, you know, you shouldn't presume to, you know, to control that unto yourself, but should give that to the greater good. I don't know, but it's an interesting speculation.
Well, even their use of the word tithing here, which I guess. What did I just learn today? I learned the etymology of tithing. Goes back to tenth.
Tenthing,
all right. Didn't know it. Didn't know that. But, yeah, they invoke the word tithing here. Not a lexical flight of, you know, not to be taken lightly. I mean, does it have religious overtones, or is it more just like them saying, no, this is a tenth and it's cosmic? And, yes, it's for the public treasury and for secular things, but it's still...
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, in our current mentality, it has religious connotations because that's because it, you know, it got, you know, the idea got fed to us by revelators long ago, right?
Right.
But, you know, it's not just a religious thing, right? It's an everything, what they're getting at here, you know, and that's just an intriguing fact. You know, that you could go and visit any of trillions of worlds and you'd find them talking about tithing there.
Food for thought.
Yep.
All right, shall we
yeah.
read our tithation rates here?
Yeah. Now let's get the bullet points on disbursement here.
All right. Get out your taxation tables. Here we go. Number one. Okay, so they're dispersed as follows. Number one, 3% was expended in the promotion of truth, science, education, and philosophy. Two, 3% was devoted to beauty, play, social leisure, and art. Three, 3% was dedicated to goodness, social service, altruism, and religion. Four, 1% was assigned to the insurance reserves against the risk of incapacity for labor resultant from accident, disease, old age, or unpreventable disasters.
Again, it's like, wow, this reminds me of passages in Government on a Neighboring Planet, right?
Sure.
It does.
Yeah. And of course, you know, that's because that, you know, that advanced continent there on the neighboring planet, you know, is still playing forward ideas that were fed to them from, you know, their planetary prince and staff and their Adam and Eve, you know, before their rebellion and their default, and you know, not to mention their ongoing philosophic recognition of the patterns of things. But you know, so here it is again, having the insurance. You know, the public insurance, you know, system here. But then, you know, to actually codify truth, beauty, and goodness.
Yes.
To take the existential triplet, right, and make them overarching umbrellas, you know, for specifics of... human activity.
And the symmetry of each one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, each has three elements, and yeah, so there's all kinds of stuff you can kind of contemplate about the patterns there and things, but just, you know, noticing that, you know, when you go through those nine, you know, you start with science and you end with religion. Right?
Yeah.
So they're kind of playing through an interesting sort of a spectrum there. You know, where it's divided into three domains. We are noticing that they didn't put them in the order beauty, truth, goodness. They put them in that order truth, beauty, goodness.
Yeah.
Just to remind you again of, it's very much so for these worlds. You're thinking top down, right? You start with the transcendence of truth, and then go down to the elements of beauty and goodness. You know, and philosophies there, of course, is truth, because you are ever more so when you get into light and life, you know, transcending what we think of as science and religion and getting into a state of, you know, a Morantia-like philosophy, all-encompassing philosophy with individuality, an individuality phase of cosmology and a unity phase of divinity within it.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So all those sorts of things are in play. But, you know, aside from all of those fun details, just the fact that you've got 3%, 3%, 3%, 1%, you know, these precise delineations, again, the order, the divine law behind everything. More and more, we would so fight against the kind of rigid system that these people live in. Right? They're comfortable with their liberty being in a lot of law. where we, are still working on, our false liberty issues.
I mean, changing tax rates here is a major election issue every election season. Here, it's been that way for a few hundred thousand years. We don't really mess with it.
Yeah. And it's very,
they definitely have a flat,
it's very simple.
Here. 10%.
Indeed. Exactly. It's right. Fairly uncomplicated. You wouldn't need H&R Block and those guys.
No.
Trapped. The buggy whip makers will have to go out of business.
The poor lobbyists. The poor lobbyists.
All those poor lobbyists, yes. What will they do? Maybe they'll focus on truth, beauty, and goodness instead. All kidding aside, the love of God, the truth, beauty, and goodness of God, and the law of God, it's all together in one coordinated system. I just see it that way, that's what they're trying to present to us.
I have a question.
Yep.
We in our planetary mortal epics, it seemed like getting into those later stages seemed more perfect than what we're seeing here. It feels like a step back or something. Does anybody get that? Am I just not perceiving properly? I mean, I got the sense that light and life was better than what we ran into in planetary mortal epics, and yet here they're really getting granular with how it's not perfect.
Yeah, that's why I was stressing that again as we were just talking about that. We are way beyond anything that we would imagine about, defectiveness, degeneracy, disease, you name it. But there are still those issues at a level of refinement that we can't even imagine.
That's what I'm picking up on then. That's what I'm sensing.
Yeah. Yeah.
They've gone down to another level of magnification, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, we joke about first world problems. Light and life world problems, they're everything to them. For us, it's like, seriously, you're worried right. about that? It's like, whatever.
Right.
Again, we just, again, it's because, you never run out of the precision of the absolute law, right? It's, every time you deal with one layer of conformity, right, there's a deeper, finer layer under that, and again and again and again. Us as individuals developing and ascending, we finally get perfection of purpose, and then they'll allow us, into Havona to be able to follow the laws of the house there, the economy of Havona.
Yeah.
Think about that, the laws of that house there, of Havona. Right? We're talking about worlds that are moving towards that kind of fine precision, of conformity. billions of people, and no one in, over their entire life ever forgets to dot an I.
Right.
You know.
And the finite is just not destined to endure in any level of perfection or any level of completion, I guess. The finite is just the beginning.
Yeah, when you finally put the final dot on the final I, you know, then everything transcends and, you know, starts at the basement floor again of the absentite.
Right.
I just had a thought that I don't want to get too off track, but I did want to share it. Chris, you've talked about the process of moving up through the universe ascension process. We're moving towards unity, and when we reach the central universe, there's a reciprocation to where we're now working on the integrity of our individuality. And I'm thinking about these worlds of light and life, and I'm thinking of them in a planetary stage as the whole world is sort of moving in this direction together. There's this wholeness of the planet itself. But in Havona, there's already a perfect sphere. Those billion perfect spheres are already perfect, and it's the part. It's the part that is making that move towards integrity, not the world itself. So I just wanted to throw that out there because I never really had that thought before.
Right, yeah. Out here, the inside and the outside are evolving together.
Yeah.
Right, but in there, like, no, the outside is done. It was done from the beginning. You know, you have to meet the challenge of it, you know, by continuing to grow within until finally you have so much within that you can, you know, engage, you know, in some purely internalized way the absoluteness of the aisle.
Yeah.
You know, really use the absolute dimension of your personality as an absolute dimension to some degree instead of just a supreme one. You know, obviously it's going to, you know, as you go beyond the sixth circuit of Avona, you know, these achievements, you know, trans supreme, you know, are more and more internal and, you know, the essence of achievement, you know, rather than, you know, don't get carried away at some grandiose substance of achievement here. You know, you're still going to be a finite being when you're on the aisle. But still, you know, to go you know, inward from the sixth circuit is to begin to challenge yourself to engage that which is super supreme.
Right.
Right. It's, I mean, talk about needing grace to achieve. But you've got your personality. You have, you know, the core of your body, that fragment of infinity, your thought adjuster, right, is, you know, you now, you know, and you're leveraging the two to go super supreme in essence. And you know, just to remind ourselves why that's, you know, thinking about that ascension career is relevant to here. I mean, you know, we're taking worlds forward. You know, these worlds are ascending like individuals ascend.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And eventually,
right,
you can think of a local universe, the entire local universe, as ascending up to the level of the super universe.
Hmm.
Right. And you know, eliminating that hierarchical differential that used to be there.
And there are literal circuits we talked about.
Yeah.
Actual circuits. Yeah.
You know, and, you know, and when the local universe, you know, is settled in light and life like that, oh, then the super universe authorities finally allow officials from the local universe to actually participate in their committees and stuff.
Right. Right. Right.
Before that, you're, you know, you're a lowlife.
You don't exist, right?
Right. It's like, I mean, well, you can watch, but, you know, don't touch anything, please. So, I mean, the hierarchy of this, you know, again, of this ever more, you know, unimaginable precise conformity we're talking about.
All right. Well, let's see. Justin, you want to take the reading next?
Sure. Thanks, Brad. The natural resources of this planet were administered as social possessions, community property.
Ooh, just one little sentence for a paragraph. Yeah. And again, if you're familiar with government on a neighboring planet paper, that should immediately make you think of statements there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The natural resources, you know, being, you know, likewise administered there. This whole, see, evolutionary question of, we should adopt that right now. Let's take away everyone's, you know, mineral rights or whatever. It's like, no, right, that there is an evolutionary process going to differ from planet to planet. But, you know, here you at least know that, you know, you're heading towards that kind of a system, right, where they're administered as social possessions, community property. And one of the things that's key in that evolutionary process is, remember, nations don't go away. Nations are a foundational element, right, of the divine
right.
law. And right, nations have to stand as nations, right? So, you know, a nation needs its natural resources.
I suppose it does, yeah.
You know, think about how that's playing into this. Right, and you need to make, you know, the nation needs to make sure that, you know, you don't have some individual selling all of its natural resources to the highest bidder somewhere else on the planet. And he's like, no, that our nation needs that. you know, and the nation has a right to it, to even enlighten life. Yeah. So all those issues of national integrity are in play as well as individual integrity.
It is interesting how you start with the herd and you start with communism as the most primitive state, and you circle all the way back around, and you eventually get back to this light and life stage where you have community property. It's interesting that process circles back on itself.
Right. Now, until the fullness of time, it's bad.
Yes.
It's not good.
Yes.
Yeah, and to understand how that fits in every world, and it has a different, you know, it's going to follow a different path, and all the complexities. You know, that's the big issue with them giving us government on a neighboring planet. That paper. You know, and we're thinking, oh well, we don't have to think anymore. Let's just apply that to us. It's like, no.
No, you have to think even more now.
You have to think even more now.
Another pattern you brought up, Chris, with the planetary sovereign representing the father and then it being transferred over to the material son, the atom, and then it being transferred back, that follows that same sort of process of being, you're ending up where you started out. The prince is always going to start before the material son and daughter arrive, so he's going to have that role before he passes it off, and then it circles back again. So it's just an interesting little pattern.
Yeah, it's just all you know, to like I said, to think of all these things in very dynamic evolutionary terms and you know, how things can seemingly come around, like you're saying, you know, but they're coming around anew, right?
Yeah.
You know, you're going forward, you know, to a new form of that, not going back, you know, like 19th century communists wanting to go back to the beginning of human society, you know, with that primitive communism.
That's one of the double exclamation mark paragraphs. Do not take a backward step. Go forward.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. We acknowledge you might have initial, you know, vague recognitions, you know, of transcendent ideals, right? But they get applied in the future, not by resurrecting some so-called golden age of the past.
On this world, the highest honor conferred upon a citizen was the Order of Supreme Service, being the only degree of recognition ever to be granted in the Marancha Temple. This recognition was bestowed upon those who had long distinguished themselves in some phase of supermaterial discovery or planetary social service.
Yeah, and probably the only thing we need to highlight there is they know of that which they speak when they say supreme. This isn't like some petty dictator calling himself, you know, the supreme lord over all. They mean supreme.
And this is...
Yeah,
and these aren't to be confused with the equivalent of the Nobel Prize. This is super material discoveries. What does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, that, again, how we have so much of the material in hand that you can now, upon that stable foundation, focus on the mindal, you know, or the intellectual, the philosophical, and the spiritual, the religious, you know, transcendent of that super material.
Yeah.
You know, remember how they talked about, the recognition of philosophic achievement, you know, being honored in the temple.
Right. That's right.
Yeah.
Schools of philosophy. Right.
Right. So, you know, the very sorts of challenges that the Rancher book puts to us. You have to have super material interests to really engage the fifth epical revelation. If you're still only interested in material, it would most likely be better if you didn't read it, because it's probably going to just amp up your unfortunate fixation on the material.
Hmm.
Right.
Well, that's a provocative
course.
Statement. Yeah.
The majority of social and administrative posts were held jointly by men and women. Most of the teaching was also done jointly. Likewise, all judicial trusts were discharged by similar associated couples.
Yeah. Notice we had nations. We have, you have the core of families, right? The fundamental differential between men and women, and that distinction between men and women, by the time you get here into light life, is going to be all the more definitively clarified. It's like it is with the material son and daughter, right? You will have evolved from those primitive states where you know men and women have to be overlapping to some degree because of the vicissitudes of primitive times. But, you now will have them very definitively expressed. And the only way to get the whole picture, like with a material son and daughter, is to have them work in pairs.
Yeah, isn't that advanced? Look at that.
Yeah. And, and also, of course, as if they're just about to mention, the women will be living for a very long time post-childbearing, right? And so
right.
That whole mystery of, what latent potentials are there in females if they could live long enough beyond childbearing and with enough, genetic uplift and biologic and, internal integrity to begin to actualize some of these hitherto unimagined potentials. Yeah, I mean, it goes for men too, but it's just all the more fascinating to contemplate women having this opportunity to begin to manifest their ascension career in a way that females on our world really can't even imagine.
Not in this
right. Look at all the popular articles on the struggles between career and family that really capable women are struggling with and are having a hard time finding a suitable solution.
Oh, this is
a genuine dilemma in our current stage with our limited lifespan. Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. On these superb worlds, the childbearing period is not greatly prolonged. It is not best for too many years to intervene between the ages of a family of children. When close together in age, children are able to contribute much more to their mutual training. And on these worlds, they are magnificently trained by the competitive systems of keen striving in the advanced domains and divisions of diverse achievement in the mastery of truth, beauty, and goodness. Never fear, but that even such glorified spheres present plenty of evil, real and potential, which is stimulative of the choosing between truth and error, good and evil, sin and righteousness.
Okay, well, let's set the latter part aside for 1 second here. And back to the childbearing issue. When you go to interpret their statement, it is not best for too many years to intervene, right? It's not greatly prolonged. Okay, you know, keep that in proper relative terms. You know, think Adam and Eve, you know, or even more appropriately, think Adamson and Rada. Okay? So you got individuals, you know, that say they're living 500 years. So, you know, what would be a guesstimate of, to what age would a woman be childbearing? Well, yeah, a reasonable guess might be 150. Because think about how long Rada was childbearing. To have 67 children. Every time, you know, two out of each set of four were twins, still, right? She's childbearing for a long time, and of course, Adamson was 120 when he met Rada at 20.
Of course, that was sort of in their DNA that was what they were supposed to do.
Of course, right? But see, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about that is the DNA, really, of all these people on these worlds now. Right. They're all basically like material sons and daughters, or the offspring anyway of material sons and daughters.
There has to be a great deal of regulation then of procreation, either individually or maybe not from the government, because you couldn't have a world of light and life with every couple having 60 kids. I mean, the world would explode in
right,
each generation.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah,
we know all
factor that. Is too great there.
lots of regulation and whatnot, right? But
yeah.
but nonetheless, right? I mean, not too many years intervened with Adamson and Rada, okay? And that was spread out over a very long span of time. You got to keep this in relative terms. So there's that. And then, then that middle sentence, challenging you, competition, that's an evil primitive thing. It's like, no, that's a key element here. Competitive systems of keen striving, not just striving, keen striving in the advanced domains and divisions of diverse achievement and the mastery of truth, beauty, and goodness, not only very intensely, precisely focused and competitive, but in a hyper-complex, multifaceted societal structure.
I'm thinking of the childhood Jesus speaking with his father, Joseph,
mm-hmm.
about competition.
Mm-hmm. Again, see, notice all of how much they're keenly focused on getting ever more precise and all of the details of the law of God, if you will, right? The law of the universe of universes, all of its precision. Not to mention using the word trained. Oh, so they don't just, they aren't enlightened people that just let their little kids self-actualize? No. That's a godless ideal, to believe in self-actualizing children. And so all those little details that underlie these statements and how they, on the one hand, might get us excited about, we need to implement all these progressive things. No. Remember the context. It's not the false liberty that we get excited in when we hear about how the world could be structured. This is true liberty. Magnificently trained. Because all of us, in order to enter Havona, have to be magnificently trained. You have to have perfection of purpose.
You have to reflect carefully, as we often point out when studying the Urantia book. Now, I know at least one person who very affectionately calls it the operator's manual for spaceship Earth. And, that's a clever turn of phrase, and maybe parts of it are kind of intriguingly like that. But, don't take paper 55 as an instruction manual for your government's system of laws tomorrow, or you're going to crash the spaceship. It's not going to be light and life.
No, you will be a poster child for the emergency and why the book is here if you do
right.
that.
Isn't that?
Like I said, see, for those sorts of people, it's probably better if they'd never find the book because it'll just make things worse.
Nevertheless, there is a certain inevitable penalty attaching to mortal.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Before you start reading,
we didn't get to the good and the error. Yeah, we're sorry.
I forgot. That's right. Yeah, we should. Especially since you're picking up on it. Never fear. I was fraught with fear about this one. that even such glorified spirits present plenty of evil. Real and potential. I mean, notice the potential is the foundational element there. I mean, obviously the more you get into light and life, the less there's going to be, realized evil. But the inevitabilities are still in play. We can only grow in the context of contrast.
Yeah.
Right, so at least internally, the contrast has to be recognized between goodness that is actualized and evil that, is always there as a potential. That's another thing, to add into your mix, Kermit, about, wait a minute, I thought we left a whole bunch of things behind in the rearview mirror. It's like, no. Right? You may leave behind, to a very high degree, sin and iniquity, but, evil's just a fact of imperfection. You can never, not even, the creator Michael has left behind evil as a potential. He never actualizes it, but the potential is still there. He has free will.
Yeah.
So, to keep that in mind again, that you don't want to think in terms of that overemphasis on the continuumness of unity, and washing out all contrast. No, the only way things progress is in the stimulative context of contrast. If you're not stimulated, you're dead.
That would be fearful. That would be something to be afraid of. Lack of stimulation.
Got to have the courage to face the contrast in order to grow. All right.
Nevertheless, there is a certain inevitable penalty attaching to mortal existence on such advanced evolutionary planets. When a settled world progresses beyond the third stage of light and life, all ascenders are destined, before attaining the minor sector, to receive some sort of transient assignment on a planet passing through the earlier stages of evolution.
Okay, just real quick here. We don't have a lot of time to belabor things here. But why beyond the third stage? Remember how there's this parallel between the planetary mortal epochs, you know, and it's continuing on here with these stages of light and life, with your ascension career in the mansion worlds and beyond?
Right.
You know, how the first mansion world was post-Adamic, second mansion world was post-magisterial, third mansion world post-Bestowal, fourth
sure.
mansion world post-Trinity teacher son, fifth mansion world first stage of light and life, sixth mansion world, second stage,
oh,
seventh mansion world, third stage. See, so once you get past the third stage, once you get past a parallel to the seventh mansion world, right, you're going to, you need to go, you know, you need to spend some time engaging, see sort of that full earlier stages, you know, which, you know, is the nativity sphere up through the mansion world. Mansion worlds are just extensions of, you know, the spheres, okay, and then you know, you can continue on. There's if you you know, were to look at the end of paper 49 about the secondary modified orders of ascension, and then the primary modified order of ascension, you've got four more levels there. Right, those three orders of secondary, that's local system, headquarters, then constellation training worlds, and then constellation headquarters, and then the primary modified order, that's the local universe headquarters. So those are four other levels. Right? That's the fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh stages of light and life.
Hmm.
All bottled up, see, in the full hierarchy of the local universe.
As above, so below.
Right. So, that's what they're touching upon there.
Each of these successive ages represents advancing achievements in all phases of planetary attainment. In the initial age of light, the revelation of truth was enlarged to embrace the workings of the universe of universes, while the deity study of the second age is the attempt to master the protein concept of the nature, mission, ministry, associations, origin, and destiny of the Creator's sons, the first level of God the Sevenfold.
So again, you know, we did... you know, with the mortal epics, remember we the post-Bestowal was getting up to super universe, and post-Trinity teacher son was the central universe and paradise. See, the next step, the entire universe of universes, right? And then you go into the levels of God the Sevenfold, which we'll talk about more when we get into the, you know, going through the seven stages, you know, sort of formally. But the thing to just note here is, while the deity study, right, the point of, you know, is to figure out a very complicated from the reality, you know, in the reality perspective, facet of deity, the sevenfold, that facet of deity, to begin to take on the challenge of figuring out that facet of deity, right, and even, you know, on a first level basis from a reality perspective, right, it's the protean concept of, you know, and then they list all those different things as the Creator's sons. It's very complicated. Right? Then throw in the uncountable number of master physical controllers and whatnot, and, you know, it's very complicated. But you begin to take that on You have minds with that vast a capacity that can be take on that challenge, second stage of light and life.
Well, Kermit, would you like to take over the reading?
Kermit, did we
unmute Kermit, or
maybe he's on mute?
Yeah, it was a muting thing. Yes, thank you. A planet the size of Urantia, when fairly well settled, would have about 100 sub-administrative centers. These subordinate centers would be presided over by one of the following groups of qualified administrators.
So just note there's 100 sub-administrative centers, again, reminding of how there are definitive enduring nations. There's that individuation of the planet still.
Right.
It isn't all blurred into one, uniform sphere.
One, young material sons and daughters brought from the system headquarters to act as assistants to the ruling Adam and Eve.
Okay, so that's pretty straightforward. We kind of get that. Again, they wouldn't be procreating, obviously, but they're brought just like the original material son and daughter were to help out and not be biologic uplifters.
Two, the progeny of the semi-mortal staff of the planetary prince who were procreated on certain worlds for this and other similar responsibilities.
Semi-mortal, semi-material staff, the original corporeal staff, when they leave, normally when Adam and Eve arrive, but they procreate, they've already procreated the primary midwayers, but they also leave behind material progeny. Zuster indwelt material progeny, right? They create a pure line that go on. They live and die, but it's the progeny, this ongoing descendants that continue to be assistants to the planetary prince. Right? So they're going all the way, forward into light and life like that in that pure line state, and possibly running some of these sub-administrative centers.
Three, the direct planetary progeny of Adam and Eve.
So not all of their progeny, blend in. Some of they maintain pure line ones. They go on and on and on and on.
Four, materialized and humanized midway creatures. What is that?
Secondary midway creatures. Right, they have the sixth and seventh adjutants and Marantia mind. So if you take them from being their horizontal and stationary states and you make them upwardly oriented, up from the humus, right, humanized, right, you make them, you flip them up 90 degrees into an ascending mode, and you can take them one way or the other. Here you're seeing materializing them. They can also be humanized in the Marantia, either direction. But here some of them are materialized, right, so they can kind of be like the direct progeny of Adam and Eve, sort of thing. That sort of a mode.
So they would
not
have adjusters.
Come back on these.
They would then have, they have adjusters when they're humanized.
Okay,
that's what I was going to ask. Yeah. Five, mortals of adjuster fusion status who, upon their own petition, are temporarily exempted from translation by the order of the personalized adjuster of universe chieftainship in order that they may continue on the planet in certain important administrative posts.
Probably requires an individual with a self-acting adjuster, I would think.
Six, specially trained mortals of the planetary schools of administration who have also received the Order of Supreme Service of the Marantia Temple.
There you see, now, Supreme Service is not a flippant adjective, right?
Seven, certain elective commissions of three properly qualified citizens who are sometimes chosen by the citizenry by direction of the planetary sovereign, in accordance with their special ability to accomplish some definite task which is needful in that particular planetary sector.
Okay, so you've got these sort of ad hoc commissions of three that can be brought into play too.
Yeah,
and giving you some flavor of all of the, you know, the hoops that, you know, are jumped through. You know, again, the order of everything is very detailed and very precise.
Right. The great handicap confronting Urantia in the matter of attaining the high planetary destiny of light and life is embraced in the problems of disease, degeneracy, war, multicolored races, and multilingualism.
Yeah, so you know, we've already talked some about, you know, all of these primitive, very coarse level things like disease, degeneracy, and, you know, and the animal origin, naturalness of war. But again, as about to reemphasize in the final paragraph, we have, you know, we don't have one race, right, and one language. We have multi.
Right.
Like they told us a long ago. I mean, by the time you get to the end of the post-Adamic, you know, you normally have one race, the, you know, that one quote-unquote white race, right? That is predominantly the, you know, the biologic nature of the material son and daughter.
Right.
Right.
Those are
big problems.
They are. But
yeah, it's
that
pretty
list
hard
there
to
is,
look down
also,
the line. I was just going to say it's pretty hard to look down the line and see multicolored races and multilingualism giving way anytime soon.
Adam and Eve defaulted, you know, they could have established one language long ago, but no.
Right.
You were going to say something, Brad?
It's a catalog of things that at earlier stages of planetary evolution are good, right? They're
yep.
They're essential even. It's just the question is when do they become outmoded? You know, war
is
essential.
Right. All of those things are differentials that power evolution to begin with.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And are right. appropriate. But eventually all good things taken to extreme become bad.
Yeah.
And along those lines, Kermit, with the anytime soon in the language department, you've got the think of what the profit motive has done in pushing us closer and closer to having a sort of global language. So it is moving in that direction.
We have supreme service they're talking about, you know, service mode and stuff, but right, not ahead of its time.
Right.
Right. No evolutionary world can hope to progress beyond the first stage of settledness in light until it has achieved one language, one religion, and one philosophy. Being of one race greatly facilitates such achievement, but the many peoples of Urantia do not preclude the attainment of higher stages. Oh, interesting.
Okay, so two sentences there. The first one, right, and like we were just mentioning, and as we've read, on a normal world, the one language, one religion is well in the rearview mirror by the time we're talking about light and life stages, right? You know, including one race usually too. But the one philosophy, see, that's the issue, right? Even on a world where everything is going just so, it might be a world where it takes a while to get to the one philosophy. Right. And hence that world can't go to the second stage of light and life.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Right. That what
it
is that one
like
philosophy? That's kindred minds.
Ah.
Right.
All right.
And then,
sure.
Then quickly, a few seconds left here. Right. Why could we maybe get going forward? Because we started with one race. Right. And if you biologically engineer us upward, you can kind of bring in that foundation of the one race we started with, you know, can serve us going forward.
I never thought of that. Never thought of that.
No,
yeah.
I didn't either. Thank you. Thank you for that thought piece to leave us on there, Chris. We will have to leave it there. Tune in next week. More interesting studies. Follow the way.
Take care.
God bless all.
Yep. Take care, everyone. Maybe we can talk about that last bit a little bit next time. Have a great week, everyone. Love you all.